Welcome to the Joanne Averson podcast. And in this episode, I'm really thrilled, as ever, to be sharing an interview with my friend, my colleague, my guide, my go-to person when anything to do with the human body comes into question, John Sharkey. It's always a pleasure to talk to John. And this particular episode was actually recorded last year when John posted something on Facebook all about fascia as a process. Now, for those of you that listen to my podcast, you know, fascia is a huge theme in my life. And over the last couple of decades, nearly three in fact, I've been working with this fabric of the human form and trying to understand it through language. And John has wonderful ways of seeing that, of understanding that. And he talks us through in this episode why language is so important and what language we're looking for to describe fascia and to navigate this paradigm shift that we're in from understanding bodies as biomechanical parts into what that actually means to us in our experience of everyday life when we realize that our bodies are whole and complete from the outset, and that from embryo to elder, we fold and enfold the same continuous fabric. Now, John talks in this episode about the difference between continuity and contiguity. And for me, that word contiguity was a new word. And what it really is about is when two things come together and form a boundary between them. Because that's one of the things that happens in the fascial matrix within the body. It folds and enfolds and does something called invaginate, which means it folds in on itself. And where those folds meet, indeed, there is apparent contiguity. In other words, a border forming between two things. But in the larger picture, everything in the human body originates from one piece of tissue. So in actual fact, the context of that contiguity is continuity, because everything from that one piece of bioorganic origami is effectively folded and enfolded within and around the parts that it forms from within the wholeness. And it's really quite difficult to imagine and see that. And we're only just beginning to understand it in terms of a reflection, the outer cosmos to the inner cosmos. But really, essentially and importantly, the role of consciousness. We are conscious living beings. So what does that mean? So in this podcast, I invite you to sit back and listen, maybe listen to some bits a couple of times, because it's really a deep dive on some of those questions. And even if you hear words that you're not familiar with, just stay with it, because John has the most brilliant way of explaining himself and embellishing on a point to bring us a picture that clarifies our own inner questions. And if you're anything like me, you're like, wow, I don't know if I could repeat that, but I feel better for knowing it. So tune in and have fun. And I can't wait to hear from you what you think of this podcast. Welcome, John Sharkey. Welcome, my friend, John Sharkey. Great to have you.
Thank you, Joanne Averson, once again.
Pleasure to be here. I wanted to ask you, let's get straight to it. You wrote a brilliant piece on Facebook that was a little excerpt of something that I know you've been working on for a while about fascia as a process. It was a great piece. I loved it. And I just wanted to go through it with you so my listeners get a feel for what's behind the scenes of this discussion that's frankly taken the best part of 40 years, hasn't it?
You could say that. And I mean, I'm particularly pleased with the response from people. I wasn't quite sure what people would think of, because in many ways, to look at what I'm talking about when I say the fascia is a process, it's coming at it from an ontological our philosophical viewpoint, and I suppose we'd also get into epistemology, and we would get into metaphysics. Not that I want to get into a discussion about monism and dualism. That's not for today. No. But really, I wanted to just offer people an opportunity from a philosophical viewpoint to talk about what we call process, a series of actions or a series of steps taken in order to achieve, you know, a specific goal or outcome. And I think that from that perspective, fascia is an ideal vehicle for that particular conversation. But as I say, it's more of a discussion within philosophy, a philosophical conversation, than anything else.
Well, before we get to that, we'll start it in a second. I just want to clarify the meaning of ontological and epistemological. Ontological.
So, ontology concerns claims about the nature of being and existence. So ontological or philosophical study of being, existence, becoming, reality, all the topics that I love, and of course consciousness. And then this way of thinking provides us with an opportunity to connect seemingly disconnected theories and to provide a path to a holistic way of viewing human form, because the study of the human body, you know, of course, through dissection, through anatomical dissection, is incredibly important and incredibly useful. However, the risk is that if we do not take a little time to remind ourselves of the fact that everything is in continuity. In fact, I'm even having difficulty at times using words like connected, you know, because I feel then that gives an impression that two things were separate, but then they came together. And as I say, there is an aspect of that in the human body, which could be seen as what we call contiguity as opposed to continuity. In other words, from a fascial viewpoint, the way you develop it as an embryo, your viscera are beginning to form outside your body. Your body's far too small in the early stages. Your body, so it all has to happen outside in the umbilicus. And then what happens basically is that original fabric, that original connective tissue, this fascial tissue, then begins to swirl and rotate and comes back into the body. And from that viewpoint, you could say, well, is that not a form of a contiguity, John? And I'd say it looks that way, but I think that the term contiguity belongs in a different science, geology, whereas we grow ourselves and it's just one continuous tissue that twists and spirals and rings, thickens, becomes tendons and ligaments, and it's just one thing.
So I love this discussion, because as a clinical anatomist, that means that, you know, there's a lot of us in the world learning dissection now, that labs are being opened more and more to practitioners and movement teachers and so on to have access to the anatomy lab. So, you know, I call myself a happy dissector. I've worked very hard. I've made many, many, many dissections. I've done many, many hours in the lab, but I still call myself a happy dissector, because the truth of the matter is, I am not qualified as a clinical anatomist. Now, I know in your case, you spent many, many years becoming a clinical anatomist. It saddens me greatly. It's not a protected title. I hear people using the term, oh, I'm an anatomist, meaning I study anatomy, but it's not the same thing. I study anatomy. But when we get into the laboratory with you, John, and have the privilege of seeing you in Ohio State University Anatomy Department, or Dundee University Anatomy Department, or King's College London, or wherever, you know, I could name many places, the privilege is of the profound years of understanding and study that you've brought together. Obviously, a medical doctor can't become a medical doctor without their understanding of anatomy being sanctioned by a clinical anatomist. So it's like it's a whole other level. But you also, as a movement teacher and a manual therapy teacher, you know how to bring that together and translate it into practice. And you've often said to me, we need to have different understandings of fascia for the different professions. you know, surgical specialization, whether it's brain or viscera or limbs and orthopedics and so on, require different understandings of different kinds of fascia. And don't you think that that is part of the struggle that we all have, that you are trying to address here with your many, many years of this profound understanding of all the fasciae of the human body? Or it's not a plural, another question, as all one piece. And you studied embryology. So bringing all that together and making sense of it as a whole, that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you about this, because I think it's so important. We go off down these different roads. We have these different requirements at different levels. How do we find a language that brings that all together and forms the common denominator that we can all speak, at least as a starting point, before we specialize?
Yeah. I think that the answer to that is we don't.
I love that. Yeah, it's hopeless, Joe.
We don't, because, you know, we can try to, and I've tried to, but the reality to that is that you need to change the words that you use and the vocabulary that you use based upon the audience that you're speaking to. So let's say, for instance, we were talking to a child, you might say, look at the moo cow. You know, you might point into a field and say, look at the moo cow. If you were, you know, an adult and you were involved in you know, bovine sciences, you would say, look at the Frisian heifer. So you wouldn't use the term moo cow. And so that's one aspect of it, that you have to use the appropriate language for the particular age group that you have. But also then there are those people, let's say, for instance, we look at the communities within which we occupy. So in one breath, in fact, just this week, I was in a hospital and I was working with surgeons who are specializing in forearm and hand approaches. But then, you know, I could be talking to a group of, you know, yoga practitioners next week. So there are people who are involved in, you know, the substances, the stuff of life. You know, what are we made of? But then there are other people who are also interested in the non-physical stuff. In other words, thoughts and ideas. And one of my favorite topics, the topic of consciousness. And how do those things arise out of the solid substance, you know, the stuff that comprises the physical universe or the physical things that can occupy space, us, you know, and that includes ideas and thoughts. And so we have to be able to, you have to be able to have a different set of words, a different set of explanations for the different communities to who you are talking. If there is one common denominator that has to come out of it, or that needs to come out of it, it's the word continuity. If you want to say connectedness, okay, we say connected, that everything is connected to everything else. Because when we talk about fascia and fascia as a process, we say ubiquitous, we say omnipresent, we say everywhere. So fascia is everywhere. And so from a surgical viewpoint, it's so important that the surgeon realizes that making an incision or cutting away fascia, if it can be avoided, is something that should be avoided, because that can have an effect further away. Now, if somebody requires a fasciotomy, if somebody has necrotizing fasciitis, or they have some type of serious infection, then of course one has to do what one has to do. And in this case, it might be removing the fascia. But I would say then that you have to understand as well that there's a consequence to doing that. And that's what you do. You weigh up the odds to say, well, you know, what's pressing here? Remove the fascia and remove the vehicle upon which the infection is spreading, or leave it in place and the person risks losing a limb. So I would say that's the decision then becomes reasonably easy, that you have to remove the fascia. If somebody wishes to gain access to a body part,
right,
then you need to try to protect the integrity of the fascia. And it would be good, as I say, this is where I come in from an embryological viewpoint, to show the surgeon how to be able to get from point A to point B in the shortest distance and with minimal disruption. So I don't know if I went off the point slightly there, Joanne, with you, but what I'd say is that I think we do need different different words, different language, and a slightly different set of explanations for the different groups that we're talking to.
But do you not think that your idea of fascia as a process begins to give us at least a common context?
Well, absolutely, yeah. I think that process is fundamental. I think it's, or more succinctly, process is a foundation of reality. And as I said at the very beginning, you know, a process is a series of actions or steps that are, you know, that are taken in order to be able to achieve a particular goal, whether that is blinking your eyes or whether it's, you know, me picking up a can to have a little drink. Cheers.
Cheers.
And it all happens within a fraction of a second. But, you know, some philosophical perspectives such as holism emphasize the idea that the whole is more than the sum of its parts. And so that's part of the process. You know, in that context, fascia can be seen as contributing to the overall unity and functioning of the body. The process of the body as a whole, in other words, supported by this ubiquitous connective tissue.
Yeah.
You know, which is a whole series of kind of characteristics and personalities, you know?
Well, this is where it gets really important and fascinating to me because, you know, spiritual science is my thing.
Mm.
And for me, the fascia is the interface. You know, when we talk about an embodied practice, I find myself kind of giggling a bit because it's like, well, which bit of your practice isn't embodied? You know, where else can you go? And for me, fascia is like something like the interface between the beingness and the body that expresses that beingness. And actually part of our life's path might be enhanced by bringing congruency between those things. So I think congruency is a very powerful feature. But again, we have to put that in a philosophical box, if you like, if we've got to put it in a box. But the thing that I loved about what you wrote, and I'm going to quote you a little bit of just the opening paragraph, this philosophical conceptualization highlights the role of fascia as a process in development, maintenance, remodeling, integration, communication, while underscoring the significance of fascia as a continuous, indispensable process in the functioning and well-being of the human body. Now, you've encapsulated there so much information, but what I think is so powerful about it is it makes everybody right in what they say about the fascia, but what it seeks to also do is provide a context as to why we have to keep aware that at different times, in different places, under different circumstances, with different people, it changes.
Exactly.
And this, I think, is so hard for people to get their head around, is that actually the unchanging nature of being human is predicated on its changing constantly.
Constantly. For more than moment.
Literally. And that is, and it's unique to all of us, which actually makes us all the same. And this is where I think, for me, there's this huge difficulty between stereotypical analysis of what is the fascia content and archetypal awareness of what is the fascia context. And I think your word process provides us with such a, well, you use the words here, such attitudes and beliefs have a significant impact on how anatomists, doctors, surgeons, and other medical and paramedical specialists view the nature of human form and function. And I wanted you to address that because I know you are never making the medical fraternity wrong. I mean, you're partly responsible for their qualification. So how are we moving towards this idea that we've got practitioners that we want to wake up to the power of the movement they're teaching or the manual therapy they're teaching, and we want doctors to understand this profound and important context of the tissue that originally they were trained to throw away?
Yeah, I mean, well,
in some instances.
Okay, so that's not exactly, that's not necessarily, not necessarily true. It would depend on your speciality once you've done your undergraduate medical degree. Certainly in terms of anatomy. Now, there are opportunities for people to do a pure anatomy degree.
Right.
There are other qualifications where people might have a major in anatomy. I was talking to one of my students actually at NTC just last week, and she did a degree. I'm sorry if I can't remember what the title of her degree was, But she did she specialized, in anatomy. So that's not a pure degree. And she was making that point to me. She said, no, John, it's not a pure degree in anatomy, but, you know, I majored in anatomy. And I think that's fantastic. I think that's wonderful. But having said that, there was no mention of fascia within her degree, and she did do some cadaveric dissection. So from that viewpoint, the fascia is taken away, and the fascia is not discarded. I wouldn't like anybody to think it's discarded. Nor I want to encourage people, by the way, not to refer to the containers under the tables as bins. We don't put connective tissue or fascia or anything in bins. That is not what we do. We store them and we keep them safe and we protect them and we ensure that we can account for, you know, every piece of tissue on any particular donor. So rest assured of that. But what would have happened was there was an emphasis on blood vessels, an emphasis on nerves and nerve pathways. So the way to see nerves and to see blood vessels, you know, very clearly was to cut away or scrape away the fascia. And in fact, it's quite interesting to look at nerves and blood vessels invested or wrapped up in the fascia, because you can talk then about fascia as a kind of a form of conduit. And this was the means by which nerve vessels could make their way around the body. So, in the medical sciences, there were many people who had a great interest in fascia.
Yeah, absolutely.
But perhaps not quite from the viewpoint of connectivity, from the viewpoint of continuousness, and therefore the discussion of how does fascia in the foot have an effect with the shoulder on the opposite side or with the head. Now, there are many people who would have used different vehicles for explaining such connections, the reflexologists, the palmologists, the acupuncturists, even the, you know, for the most part, bodywork therapists, generally speaking, people who specialize in cranial or craniosacral therapies, because they would believe that by working on the head and the intracranial tissues, that this can have an effect further downstream, and rightly so. So there certainly is a whole cohort of people out there, populations and communities out there. But what they need is they need good scientific explanations for how those connections occur, what the dynamic between them is. And in fact, we may never be able to explain everything. Because, and that needs to be accepted somewhat, by the way, which, you know, from the Big Bang to multi-universes to the James Webb telescope way out there a million miles away from Earth, and we still can't find, you know, the edges of our own universe, and we're wondering, is that because it's infinite, and what does infinite mean? So if we can't, you know, and I don't expect us to be able to necessarily get to the bottom of those particular questions. Well, we have questions regarding the inner universe.
Yes.
And I think that it's fair to say that we may never be able to get to the bottom of them, but that should not stop people from having a hypothesis, and a reasonable hypothesis based upon the following. If you can put forward a good, strong argument. So from a philosophical viewpoint, you know, we talk about interconnectedness. So the fascia acts as the, I don't know, no matter what words I use, I promise you I'm going to be disappointed with myself when we finish the conversation. Say, gosh, John, you probably shouldn't have used that word. But you could say it's the connective glue that binds all the disparate parts of, you know, the so-called parts, what I would call the differentiated specializations that are part of that continuity. In other words, it forms a network that allows for the communication or the exchange of information between the organs, the muscles, the tissues.
You know, so everything that's moving them in real life. Let's not, as you
moment
said,
to moment, it's a process of continuous interaction and integration, dynamic function.
I love it. And this is the thing that we have this idea that glue, you know, when I love that you've used that word, because obviously
really?
It's
wrong. I wasn't sure.
I'm sitting here thinking glue. Are you kidding me? Because we think glue sticks something to something else and it stays there, when actually what's so amazing about this liquid crystal matrix is that it glides, but it binds. And it's like, this is where I think we have the difficulty, that the language we use. We've had this discussion about stretch, but we're not going to put that in this one. We've had this discussion about all kinds of things, but it's got to be sticky in the sense that it's not separated and it's bound and it's interwoven, but it's also glued by the liquid crystal matrix that it is. It's kind of that brilliant thing that I always come back to, which is proprioception, comes from the Latin proprio, meaning one's own. And perception from perception. So proprioception actually means one's own self-perception. It's like a reflexive verb in French. So what it is, it's actually how you self-aware yourself. Mm-hmm. And that sends us into a loop that takes us outside of intellectual process, which is where I wanted to take you next and ask you. Because movement is not an intellectual process, and truly understanding manual therapy isn't entirely an intellectual process. And we know this as practitioners, just trying to write notes about what you did. You cannot quantify the quality and the qualia that are, and the quiescence and these beautiful qualitative sensory awareness things that I can't find words for. And when we talk about glue, it's almost like it's static. Glue makes it sound static, but I get why you're saying, because it's never separate. It's never unstuck unless it's in trouble. So I'm right with you. But what I wanted to take you to is how we bring process in. You say the words, once formed, the process of fascia involves a continuous cycle of maintenance. And we often together use words like folding and enfolding and unfolding. And you write here, fascia plays a crucial role in preserving tissue tension, allowing for efficient force transmission and distribution during movement and physical activities. And your word, hence the term fascia integrity.
Yes.
And this is where
forgive me when I use this word, because I know I wrote it, but I think that comes in there beautifully. I think that that is just a beautiful segue into the term fascia integrity. And the term fascia integrity is not meant to replace anything else. It's not, you know, a model. It's not, all it is a word, a made up word. Many people have made up words, which helps you and I, because you and I come up with the term, it helps you and I to be able to have the conversation with the communities that we mix with, the people that, you know, we want to have an influence on. And those people want to go back into their community and they're struggling. They want to have language and they want to have words that will help them. Mm. And of course, people loathe something like a new word, not too many, but, you know, if you have a new word, my goodness, we could come up with hundreds. But fascia is such a popular word at the moment. And by the way, just, I don't know if I've mentioned this before in previous conversations, but, you know, you can be led into this false sense of security thinking that, well, everybody now knows a fascia. When you go to countries like Denmark and Sweden, go further afield outside of Europe, and you find that people haven't heard the word fascia. They're not involved in the conversation at all. We certainly are in places like North America, Canada, United Kingdom, Ireland, and well, you know, predominantly me in Ireland. Other than that, there's not too many people.
Yeah, and Europe, there's plenty of them.
Yeah, because we're such a small country. But at the same time, you know, certainly from the medical world perspective is what I'm talking about. Really, when I was up in Bowman Hospital just the other day, I was talking to people and really fascia wasn't on their radar at all. So as I say, we can fall into this full sense of security that, well, there's a big body of knowledge on fascia out there now and people know all about it. Well, they don't. And in fact, even the word fascia for me sometimes straitjackets me because, you know, I use the word fascia because fascia is popular. And so therefore it makes sense to use that term. But as you know, I would include, you know, the hard or soft tissues, bone. I would include liquid fascias. And so on, but that doesn't meet the current definition. So
current medical definition of fascia, John?
Well, if I was to sum it up in just a couple of words, it's a dissectable sheet.
Right.
Or sheet.
Right.
And what? S-H-E-E-T or S-H-E-A-T-H.
Right. So what we've seen, in teal, suffix, in fixed dissection and in fresh frozen dissection, all the forms that we have. And thank you, Jean-Claude Gamberto, for showing us what it looks like in living bodies under the magic view of an endoscope. We have all these ways of seeing that invite us to consider this body-wide matrix. And I know there's lots of conclusions about it and lots of stories about it, and everyone has their view. But I think one of the most fundamental parts of this that I invite you to just comment on is that we have been encouraged for the last 400 years, we know why, to think of the body as made up of parts on a biomechanical basis, and those parts are somehow imagined how they work together as a whole. And what we're saying is, no, you began whole and complete, and that wholeness, and Jaap van der Waal is so brilliant at describing this, that from this wholeness, the parts emerge. Now, you might think that's just a semantic play on words, but actually it's a very, very fundamental shift, paradigm shift in understanding, because what we're saying is, listen, the whole body self-organized all the parts, and when you cut into one of those parts, you are affecting the whole body. And I know that this was something that caused quite a stir in the conversation you had at the International Federation of Associations of Anatomists in 2019. And I know it was the first time that many surgeons were actually kind of brought up close and personal to the impact of an abdominal surgery on another area of the body. I've met surgeons who've explained to me, no, fascia's what wraps muscles. And I'm like, And I've had to shut up because I'm either being operated on or with someone who is, and I'm not a clinical anatomist, and I don't argue with doctors because I have huge respect for them.
But perhaps, though, there is something that wraps up muscles. But what does that mean, then, that's something
separate? Well, like a polythene bag. You know, when you put food in the freezer in a little Ziploc bag and you stick it in the freezer, it's separate to everything else in your freezer, right? But it doesn't like that in the body. I mean, not in my
experience. And the communities that we deal with are, you know, are one that they many of them understand or have a good feeling, a sixth sense for connectivity. Yep. Then there are those who are, let's say, the medically qualified. And I include myself in this, by the way, because even now, I keep saying this, I am still institutionalized because I was told from the very earliest moments of coming in to do my first degree, what are you doing mixing with those people? What are you doing talking to those people? If I came across a group of people who were doing something like crystal healing, you know, my job was to laugh at them. My job was to say, you know, that those people aren't scientific at all. And then many years later, and I'm not a person, by the way, that does crystal healing, but I'm not going to laugh at them anymore. You know, you get introduced to the idea that you have a crystallized lattice as the, you know, kind of the underlying architectural support system of the human body. In other words, we are a crystallized lattice. This is where you get this term piezoelectric activities, because when you massage or when you compress, you distort those little crystals and they emit little electrical signals. So you go, hang on a second. So maybe there's something in what these people were saying. But of course, we ostracized them and we laughed at them and we even finger wagged at them. And I'm thinking, it's the same in religion. You know, my mother was very religious, and she used to go to what we call in Catholicism charismatic meetings, and people believe that they're given gifts. And I used to laugh at that. And now I don't, you know me, Joelle, I don't have a religious bone in my body, but I don't laugh at that anymore. You know, hopefully I've matured and I think I've a different perspective now on people's belief systems. So I don't have a religious bone in my body. I don't believe in a maker. But I respect other people's rights to have that belief. And the truth is that no matter what it is that we put forward, we could be wrong. All I'm ever doing is putting forward a hypothesis. That's all it can ever be. From an evolutionary perspective, you know, fascia, whatever this thing is we're talking about, I'm talking about the stuff, the connective tissue that is absolutely everywhere. And it's evolved over millions of years. It's adapted to the changing environments and to the demands at the particular time. And changes were required, because if you didn't change as the earth was changing, we're going through changes right now at the moment. You know, I mean, just, you know, but here's another expression, even though I don't have a religious bone in my body, but God bless all the people who are in Europe, you know, in Italy and Spain and other countries where they're enduring, you know, and also in the North Americas, where now they just have fire season, you know, all year round, houses destroyed, lives destroyed because of climate change, you know, and it's a real thing. And we finger wagged at those people back in the 60s.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? And this is where I love your inclusivity, because one of the things I think that is happening is that certain aspects of healing were tribal, were known within different civilizations. And there came a time when so-called governments or political interest or commercial interest came in and said, right, we're building a symbolic wall around certain therapies, and these are designated okay, and these are not. And so we now have this system whereby we've got this sort of intellectual acceptance of certain things and non-acceptance of others, like exactly what you're saying. You finger wag at what are called sham therapies. And yet you and I between us, and probably if we sat down with our team, you know, you and me and all these people, if we unite all those experiences on and off the grid, we are all eased and helped at different times, maybe by prayer therapy, or as you said, crystal healing, or someone else might think homeopathy is a sham. Yet we've got examples of when it worked, when everything else failed. There's more to the healing process than perhaps we know.
And which we then explain as placebo, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've got names for it. But where I want to shift to is this idea that this is not just an intellectual process. This is an instinctive awareness process. This is an intuitive process. And fascia manages all of them because, and I'm quoting you now again, fascia is the tissue of temporality and the timing and time that we take to do things, and the development of us shifts this tensional network over time. And if every stroke, every gesture that we've ever made in our lives is basically annotated in this network, this extraordinary internal worldwide web inside of us, then, you know, you talk about the fascia planes and set to act as bridges, and they allow these functional interactions, and there's a synchrony on a holistic level. And to bring in Maewon Ho, who I know is somebody that you met and love, her science, she talks about this incredible orchestration covering about 70 octaves of sound waves of different amplitudes and wavelengths and particles, that this is just basically a communication story of sound through the body in many ways. Now, that's a quantum leap into what sounds like spiritual stuff and a lot of work that I've learned in a mystery school. So I'm right with you. I absolutely love the idea that some of this is history and we grow from it, and much of this is mystery and we're inspired by it, but we live in between both. So what can we do now? What can we bring our understanding to right now? To the language of, let's say, fascia integrity, which invites us to remember the body is pre-tensioned. And this is crucial because that makes it like the strings on a violin or a cello or the drum skin on a drum. And you write, the fascial process serves as a vital medium for sensory feedback and communication within the body. Specialized receptors within the fascia, such as mechanoreceptors and proprioceptors, contribute to our perception of body position, movement, and proprioception. And would you say consciousness and awareness at all sorts of subtle levels as well?
Yeah, this is one of the problems, consciousness and subconsciousness, because, for example, in the topic of stretching, a person feels stiffness or tightness in tissue. Yeah. And because of past experiences, because of learned experiences, they are told that the way to deal with that is to stretch it. Whatever this word stretch means. Now, bear in mind, as I say, from the viewpoint of anatomy, because I'm not going to go into all of the others. I'll just use two. I'll use from anatomy, the term stretch meant to tension. That's what its intention was, and that's what its meaning was. We have a small muscle in the soft palate of our mouth called levator vili palatine.
And Levator vili palatine.
So in the palate, it's in the soft palate of the mouth. And it attaches to a small little tube, which is continuous with the internal auditory meatus, the inner workings of your ears. People will know about this little tube if you've gone into high altitude flights, because sometimes they have to do it very, very carefully, very slowly. You have to hold your nose and blow, and that equalizes the Eustachian tube, because it can sometimes collapse little small rings of cartilage in there. But the idea of naming this muscle the tensor vile palatine, it was to create a stretch. It was to create tension. And it comes from the term tendere, which I think there's a French version of it as well. And it's where tendon came from. It's the same. So in other words, tendons, the idea was to stretch, to create tension. Now, if you look up dictionaries, common dictionaries, you'll see terms like to stretch beyond normal limits or to lengthen beyond normal limits. In anatomy, again, either from a mortuary science viewpoint or from an anatomy viewpoint, if we had a donor in or we receive a body in and rigor mortis has set in, well, the rest of the tissues will have shortened, then you had to stretch them out. So the term stretch has various different meanings and various different connotations. I don't know if I've gone off the top there a little bit, but if we go back then to something you said, which was about, you know, connectedness and kind of the conversation that occurs in the human body.
I'm talking about the fact that everything is tension, so it allows that vibration or that amplitude or that range of resonance
right
to go through all the tissues.
Well, that's where we use, especially in neuromuscular therapy here in Europe, we use the term inhibition. In other words, as you've often said, muscles are not simply on and off. You know, there's tone in muscle tissue, unless you're anesthetized, but there's always a level of tone in muscle tissue. Now, if tissues are inhibited, then they do not have the correct level of tension. And therefore, that conversation can't really take place. What is the conversation? Well, the word mechanotransduction has been used to talk about the transferring of forces into what? Well, the transferring of forces into metabolism, the transferring of forces into physiology, the transfer of those forces, which are energy, we're all dealing with energies, into taste and sound and smell and movement. And then I was just going to mention there, Joanne, if it fits in with the conversation, is that it's communication. So if a virus wishes to get right down into the nuclear level of a cell, how does it do that? If cancer is going to move from one place to another, how does it do it? Well, it does it on the fascial tissue. The fascial tissue is the highway upon which all communication in the human body takes place. And if, let's say, somebody had, you know, rectal cancer, depending on the formation of the fascia, in other words, fascia can, I think as Jaap van de Vaal has beautifully said in the past, you know, fascia is a connective tissue that connects and disconnects. Now, what does he mean by disconnect? The disconnection is the folding back on itself, the invagination, which creates a cul-de-sac coupled with the fact that it becomes densified. So that if you know, some type of, you know, suspicious or bold cellular activity is occurring, cancers, mischievous activity, and they come up against this thickened connective tissue, it's hard for them, if not impossible, to get from here to here. Now, if they had enough time, they might be able to make their way through. But the idea would be that that's why certain cancers are treatable. They can go in and they can remove that connective tissue, that fascia, and then they take the cancer with it. Now, the person might have to wear colostomy bag, or but it saves their life because of the specific morphology of the fascia. And that gives people perhaps an image that things are separated, but they're not. It just happens to be that in that locality, the way in which the fascia has formed, its thickness and, you know, its overall shape, in other words, its invaginated crease, cul-de-sac, manages to separate as you do your thoracic cavity from your abdomen, you know, and so on. So it can create the possibility of separation. Having said that, if, for example, if somebody has prostate cancer, then they can also develop cancer of the brain, because the cancer cells will travel along a specific highway, fascial highway, or perhaps in that case, it would be something called Batson's plexus. But there are those, everything's connected to everything else, but it just depends on the morphology of the connective tissue. I hope I didn't go off on a tangent there. I probably did.
You did a bit, but that's not a problem, because I think it was a fascinating one where we're understanding, as you're saying, that the location and the thicknesses and the degrees and the
morphology,
the morphology of the fascia process in that area. It doesn't make all fascia a highway for all things. What we're saying is the fascia specializes in every instance and how it deals with certain foreign bodies, depending on where they are and how they emerge, whether they're managed or not. And I know you've written a number of papers on long COVID where you implicate the fascia as part of the journey of that virus.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Before we go into that, or perhaps not, we won't go into that today, but what I wanted to bring you back to was this importance of understanding that the fascia is under tension at all times, because we're formed. You know, I talk about like when you put up an umbrella and you see the spokes tensioning the fabric, and if you just open out the back of your hand and spread it really firmly, you see like spokes in the tendons at the back of the hand to each finger. And those have to stay tensioned just through the embryological forming process back to where we started. And I think that's one of the difficulties that people have in recognizing, like this word fascia integrity, why we play with it. Because what we're trying to say is that it's always under tension. It's always under tension, which means that every move moves everything else moving.
Yeah, it should
and
be on.
Act of stillness, actually keeping still is an asset, right? The ability to keep still is a very powerful asset of our well-being.
Yeah, well, when when the day comes that you pass away, that you die, your body will go back into a contractured, we call it contractured as opposed to contracted, your body will go back into a contracted state, which means that the tissues will shorten. So this is the kind of the natural, you know, preset of muscle tissue. But rather than being here in a living body, it's here. In other words, it has lengthened. It's gone through part of its physiological range. And that's what pretension is.
By forming, exactly. So what we're saying is that when you talked about that brilliantly named muscle that I'm in love with the name in the Palatino.
Tensorvili Palatini, yeah.
Tensorvili Palatini.
Tensorvili Palatini.
Yeah. That is just ever so slightly tensioned or stretched to form the bridge and have the power that it has to help us balance and. And that actually that's the principle of the tendon. So every muscle tendon, if you will, is gently kind of tensioning like the spokes of an umbrella, because if it's too much, the spoke will pop through and the fabric will tear. And if it's not enough, you've just got this soggy thing flapping in the wind. So our body lives in this beautiful middle place where it's just balanced so exquisitely the whole time. But it also means that every sound we make and every move we make resonates through all the tissue to varying degrees. And I think what you say when you call fascia a process speaks so loudly of the numerous different pathways we've just taken in this conversation. I mean, just in the last 45 minutes, we've traveled from the embryo to the...
Yeah. In fact, I realized one of the points I didn't finish was when I was talking about consciousness and subconscious, it's our belief systems and it's our previous experiences that lead us to the present to say, oh, I feel stiffness in my tissues. What does that mean? Well, I'm not sure what it means. I just, maybe I overtrained yesterday or whatever the case may be. But what's the solution, Joe? Oh, the solution is I stretch it. Well, no, again, from a different perspective, if we look at it from a neural perspective, what's happening basically is that the body internally is, you know, is having a conversation, and it views there being a threat to the system. And there being a threat to the system leads to an increase in tone. It leads to that hypertonicity, which then creates a feeling, a sensation. So really what's required in those situations is something like mindfulness, something like a focus on breath, trying to, you know, unwind a little bit. And then you'll find that stiffness and tightness will hopefully dissipate. But this idea that, you know, that we can just take the tissue and we'll pull it to where it belongs, you know, and that'll solve the problem. And it never solves the problem.
And it repeats. I remember teaching with you in a fabulous studio Rituel in Paris, where they work with gyrotonic and gyrokinesis and Pilates and yoga and all sorts of work. It was fabulous. And many of the teachers were ex-ballet dancers. And they went every single day, they had to stretch their hamstrings ready for whatever it was they were doing. And I remember you kind of challenging them out of that mindset to say, well, why don't you try this instead of stretching? And the messages we got back of the transformation in their experience, because they had to get out of the habit because the body was in a habitual pattern. But second, they then had to trust themselves to use their work to kind of calm the whole system down and, of course, raise the body's ability to appropriately relax. And it was just, oh my God. I mean, it was such a fabulous experience to get their feedback. And this brings me round. I mean, I love these conversations because as a yoga teacher and therapist, you know, sometimes people look at you when you say to them, no, I don't want you to go and stretch, because they're so happy to stretch the bejesus out of something, or they stick their fingers in something, they start pulling on a muscle that's stiff. And I'm like, no, you need that stiffness. Let's breathe it through. Let's help it a little bit. I know sometimes, you know, there's a myofascial trigger point involved and we actually need to.
There could be all of that,
Help undo it, as it were. That's where words like fascial unwinding and fascial release comes from, myofascial release, all of that language. But when we come back to this idea that fascia is a process, what I think it does that's so valuable, John, is it gives us permission to have different ways that work depending on the emergent properties of the occasion. The
dynamic interconnectedness, the interconnected nature. And then you have to understand, you have to be able to take that journey to build your knowledge base, to understand what it is that's actually happening, because you have to bring the right tools to the occasion. Just simply saying that you stretch it and that somehow stretching it resolves the issue, that's very immature, you know? And that doesn't mean to say that the solution and the answer isn't easy. It's a little bit like being asked the £1 million question on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and everybody at home seems to know the answer, but the person, you know, in the studio doesn't. And you think, gosh, why don't they know that? But, you know, you've taken a particular journey, you've gathered information, you've had certain experiences, and it's led you to a point in time. So not everybody is ready to hear that. Not everybody will be able to hear what we're saying. But don't worry about that. That's all part and parcel of the journey that you take, you know?
And what I love about this, just to sort of finish up, is that, as you said many times, fascia integrity, and I'm quoting you, fascia integrity is an invitation to bring the science that's developing and emerging about fascia and the science that's developing and emerging about tensegrity, and bring the two together in application in real life, so each one of us can adopt it and find our own way of unifying this awareness of the body and the being, the soma and the soul, that or the spirit that animates us. And I'm talking about the spirit of the occasion. I'm talking about the spirit of the being. You know, where else can we go?
Having a holistic understanding of natural phenomena. You know, that continuity and speciality within the continuity, differentiation within the continuity, but that everything is one.
And doesn't that apply to everything? It applies to a group, right? We've all got the same purpose to make a difference. And so it's not just the parts of us and the whole of us, it's the parts we are in the whole of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to have the last word here. I think you're a genius. I love you to bits. And thank you for sharing this.
Ditto. No, it's great. And we always love our, you know, our conversations. And once again, by the way, just thanks to anybody who's taken the time to listen into the conversation, being a fly in the wall for everything. And thanks to all those people who have sent emails in relation to, you can never tell what's going to land and have an impact. It's the strangest things. I was saying to you, Mark put up a little piece that I did up with cling film, and we're over 500,000 views. You know, it's just funny, you know what I mean? Like, how that suddenly land and resonate with people, but there you go, it did.
So, well, you've been doing it in our dissection classes that I really encourage any of you who haven't done a dissection, if you can have the opportunity to work with John, just take it, because it's off the top.
100% of Van Karn and Mark and Wilbur.
And Wilbur and Paul and everybody.
So many of them come in as well, yeah, so, yeah.
And I just want to say thank you on behalf of everybody who's made a difference.
Thanks to you too. It's teamwork.
Wow. Did you get what I meant at the beginning when I said that after you've listened to this podcast, you'd be so glad that you heard it, but you're not sure if you could repeat all of it? So maybe even go back and listen to it again. And thanks so much for joining us. I hope this answered some questions and possibly raised more for you. And I look forward to hearing from you. I love when you write to me. Stay close, God bless, and have a great week.